Hey, good evening, everybody, and welcome to the Veterans Breakfast Club Open Conversation Scuttlebutt for Monday, April 8th. I'm just being extra careful because today was eclipse day. I figured I'd wear the glasses all day. Man, I mean, you cannot see anything. You cannot
see. It's total blackout when you put those on.
Total blackout. Yeah, I mean, I can't. Wow. Cannot see anything. I hope all of you are having a good, had a good day, having a good evening. We're having open conversation this evening. My name is Todd DePastino. I'm the executive director of the Veterans Breakfast Club. And we have been creating these programs, these communities of listening, we call it, around veterans and their stories, since 2008. And tonight we're talking about anything you want to talk about. Several people have emailed me with topics and subjects they want to cover. You know, we like with open conversation to zip through these subjects to get as much participation in as possible. And that will be the plan for tonight. We have a poll. We have Manchus, the 9th Infantry Regiment, 25th Infantry Division in Vietnam. We have the question posed by Jim Roberts, brass or buttons, what do you prefer? I think I know what he's talking about. Not 100% positive. We have Bob Flage, who's Mobile Riverine Force in Jacksonville. I want to talk to him about his service and also about Jacksonville, Florida veterans. We might have Nadia Rupniak here about her father's service in World War II. So we have plenty of things to discuss. Before we dive in, I do want to say hello to Sean Hall. How are you doing, Sean?
I'm good. I am in the 100% totality, as you can see.
The path of totality.
Yes. Here. Oh, there it goes.
Okay. And for those of you who have been following this, better. Yeah, this you seem very bright. Pittsburgh, where we are, we're about 50 miles away, I think, from the path of totality. So it was a lot of Pittsburghers were heading out of town, headed, 50, 100 miles to check it out. I know my two kids did. And so there was a lot of buzz, a lot of people were going to work, people were going to school. I think if you're probably farther away from the zone of or path of totality, maybe it wasn't as big a deal, but hoy, 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 was it? And it was not by far the darkest it's ever been in Pittsburgh in the afternoon, I'll tell you that much. I also want to introduce Glenn Flickinger, our host of Our Greatest Generation Live and our Masters of the Air program. Did you experience the eclipse today, Glenn?
I did. I went to the upper floor of the St. Clair Library with about 100 other people and watched it. And it was okay. As I've said to Todd and Sean, I've had this insane desire to eat black cats ever since. Luckily, I haven't run across any. So. No, it was good. It was good. It would have been cool to be somewhere where watching the 100% totality on TV. That would have been pretty cool.
My understanding was that Pittsburgh was in the 97th percent totality, and a big difference, apparently 3% makes a lot of difference when you're talking eclipses between 97 and 100. 100 was something special. I thought I'd begin with our discussion of the Manchus. Manchus are, that's a nickname for the 9th Infantry Regiment. I know that we have Stan Adams with us. Hello, Stan from Missouri.
Hi.
Good to see you. You were a Manchu. And we have Matthew Wilcox, who has completed a movie, a documentary movie about the Manchu. Hi, Matthew. How are you?
How are you?
So, Matthew, how long did it take? Let me ask you first to put this movie together. I'm afraid to ask.
So this June will be 4 years.
4 years.
Yes.
Okay.
So, and in that time, it has been inadvertent with getting interviews, getting materials and all of that together. So it has been an off and on process. But right now we are about to where we need to be. When I say that, we will be releasing this summer. So,
well, I was going to say you better be about where you need to be because you have the premiere coming up on May 18th. So there's nothing like a deadline to put a fire under you. Huh?
Yes.
And this is going to be a special event. I know, a part, kind of celebration, a premiere, fundraising also. It's going to be in Fulton Museum, and I'm Fulton, Missouri. I think museum because I'm thinking history, the importance of Fulton, Missouri. in history, at William Wood University in Fulton, Missouri, on Saturday, May 18th. So anybody who's near Fulton, Missouri, I think would want to go and see it. Matthew, I would love, and I know I mentioned this to you by email, and I mentioned it to Rita and Stan also, that I would love maybe down the road to do a Zoom screening of it here. A closed Zoom screening where we could get people to register for it, watch it, and then have a conversation with Manchu veterans and you about the making of the movie. So I'm going to be talking with you about maybe arranging that down the road. What made you want to make a movie about this?
You know, it's an interesting story. In 2008, I graduated high school, and one of my teachers was a Vietnam veteran, and I'd always pick his brain and try to get some information from him. Come to find out that his name, of course, is Steve Knowlton. He's in this film, and I interviewed him back in 2020, right around COVID, because I wasn't able to do much more than I hate to say documentaries. I wanted to do other films, but I found out that I love documentaries at that point. And so I interviewed him and I got his photographs. I got his video of 8mm footage we were able to transfer. And lo and behold, I was missing a lot of the story from him. So I wanted to find out if we could find more veterans. So I went online, Facebook, and I was able to find Mr. and Mrs. Adams. And they, Mr. Adams had written a wonderful memoir. And it really is the basis to break down really 1968 to 1969 with the Manchus in the Tay Ninh province of Vietnam. Very, very detailed, it's a very unique story, but it's also a very broad story to every Vietnam veteran.
And this is the book that Stan wrote, and I know Rita was a co-writer of sorts. This is your Mokane to Mole City. Mole City, I take it, Stan, would have been like the Coochie Tay Ninh Tunnel area. That's why it's called Mole City.
No,
early, it was a base camp we built close to Cambodia, and we dug trenches, and everything was underground. So they started calling us mole.
So you were the moles. Yes. I had assumed that they were the moles because they had a tunnel system.
No, we had trenches to every bunker in a big, I don't know, probably 200-yard wide circle. And bunkers probably every 25, 30 feet, something like that.
So, Stan, what makes the Manchus special or different or important?
Well, it's part of my life. I was at a reunion. My captain said, if you don't write something down about all of us, it's going to get lost. So, that made me really appreciate the people that I served with. And from there, I started, you know, delving into a book, which has taken a long time to do, but I finally got it done. Yeah.
That's good. That's, I'm proud of you for doing that, because it's very, very, very hard to put a book together.
Yes.
It takes a lot of dedication and a lot of dredging up of memories that you might not, you know, want to recall.
Mm. Well, I'd been going to the VA hospital, and I talked to a psychiatrist there for quite a while, and I would tell different stories or, you know, things that happened to us while we were in the field, and she kept having me write down what those, battles were or whatever, and one day she said, you know, you got enough for a book. So from that's when I said, well, maybe we'll start, you know, trying to do one. So but my oldest daughter, which is an attorney, she's been fantastic. She took it over, and I wrote it out, and she worded it to where it was probably right. So
did working on the book or writing the book help you process the experience of Vietnam and any trauma that you might have experienced during the war?
Yes, it did. I could relive battles, and instead of waking up night, and thinking about all that, I can sleep all night now and not have to worry about it. So yes, it helped me. Yes.
Isn't that amazing?
Yes. Yes. It's bad because a lot of veterans won't go to the VA or, you know, go talk to someone. And that was another reason why I wanted the book, because I'll tell it out there, and these guys that was in our unit, they can give it to their kids or whatever, and they'll be able to understand what we went through. So.
Stan, many years ago, a veteran told me, he was a veteran who was also a psychologist. He said,
Wow.
you know, he said, what when you're forced to tell your story, you're taking these incoherent feelings that just bedevil you, and you're putting them out into the world. You're kind of projecting them out and making it a story so that you could kind of look at it and separate yourself from it. And that's how the healing is accomplished.
Yep. That it helped. That's the way it helped me, yes.
I got this great map from Stars and Stripes here, and I don't know if people could see this little green oval I put on. I think this is where the Manchus operated, the Tainan Kuchi area, northwest of Saigon, near the Cambodian border. When were you in Vietnam, Stan?
1968 through 1969.
Months.
Oh boy.
12 months, yeah.
November.
Wow.
Well, November of 68 to November of 69. I guess you wanted it specific or something, but okay.
Okay. And here is
Yeah.
Manchu International
Wow.
Airport,
Wow.
elevation 5 feet. I love
I
it.
haven't either.
Yeah,
Never.
wonderful, wonderful. Oh, and here is. Now,
Yeah,
when
that's.
was this? This picture would have been taken after basic training.
Yes, that was after 8 weeks of basic training. We graduated and was getting ready to go AIT, and I went out to California. So,
Okay. And then from there, shipped to Vietnam, flown to Vietnam.
Yes.
Did
We
you?
went over by plane, but some of the Manchus that I have talked to, they went over by ship. So they were on a ship for 25, 30 days before they got over there. So, and that was the first ones that went to Vietnam.
66.
Yeah, 66.
Did you feel well prepared for what you were to encounter in Vietnam?
No, I don't know if you could, I don't know if you, in basic or AIT you could teach what was going on there. So, it prepared you to maybe, take a gun and do whatever you have to do with it, but it didn't prepare you for the feelings and different things that you would feel while you're there. You can tell it. I'm getting choked up here, but you can get totally immune to death, sickness, or whatever it is. You make yourself that away so you can deal with it. I had some friends got killed, and it really bothered me, but then one day I said, I can't let that bother me because we're still going on operations every day. So, yeah.
And I was going to say another Vietnam veteran told me several years ago that he realized that part of the difficulty of coming home was that you kind of had to feel for the first time feelings that you were putting on hold while you were in Vietnam.
Right.
You're truly a friend gets killed and you step over him because you have to still fight this battle. So that's a delayed grieving process that just oh, cannot imagine.
After I got home from Vietnam at my parents' house, I was sitting there and I just it felt like I couldn't get rid of that numbness. And all the way till my mother passed away, I was sitting there and I didn't cry. And I thought then, I need help. This is not working. So
Wow.
that's when I started going to the VA hospital. So,
Wow.
yes. I just, when we got back from over there, we just turned it off. And there's, anybody says that they didn't, I don't believe them. It's with you forever.
Stan, did you know Rita then?
Well, yeah, after I got, no, not when I was in Vietnam, but after I got back, I did, yes. We met in 1974 and got married, so.
So, and I know this, I'm getting real personal here, but so you're dating, courting, about to get married. How much does Rita, at this point, 1974, how much does she really know about your Vietnam service?
Oh, well, probably first 30 years,
Nothing.
nothing. And then, like I said, when I started going to the VA, I started opening up more, and
Wow.
that's when, yeah, we spent 3 or well, almost 4 years going over battles and different things, you know, and I did a lot of research out in College Park, Maryland, where a lot of the personnel records and history records for, you know, the battalions or regiments or whatever they are. And we went there to get a lot of different information, and that really helped me write the book because I could reference somebody and what kind of a medal they got or something. You know? Right. So,
hey, Todd, it's Rita here. I just want to interject. Stan did not go to the VA hospital until after 2003. That's when we went to our first reunion. And it was, you know, I'd almost had to kind of drag him kicking and screaming to go to that and stuff, but it helped so much because I'd found the men that he served with, and that made all the difference in the world. So, yeah, we got married in 74, but he didn't go to the VA until 03.
Yes.
Rita, so, can we see you? Could you put your face on the camera?
Because I'm sorry, I was videotaping.
She's filming.
Okay. I'm sorry. I just want to see you because I want people to see you because we've gone back and forth with several, many emails. And I think what really made all the difference in Stan's life was you.
Oh, absolutely.
You are such an advocate for Stan, for veterans, for the Manchus, and for preserving the history, both in the book and in Matthew's film. I mean, you made it very clear how important this documentary is to you and how important the Manchus just as a, you know, as a group of veterans are to you. You're somebody who married into this community. I find it really inspiring and impressive how much you've devoted yourself to stand in this important history.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. It's very, well, I wrote in the book there that I really felt God put that on my heart. Years and years ago, you know, I just knew. I mean, I told Stan one time too. This he didn't really want anything to do with it. And I just told him, I said, "This is larger than you are, honey." Wow. You know, it's for all those men. I just felt like the worst thing ever from that war would have been for these men never to have seen each other again.
Yeah. Right. Exactly.
I really did, because I know they promised everybody, "Oh, we'll keep in touch," but they went home and tried to lick their wounds and shut it down.
So
I'm just so proud of him that he's, you know, the book was one thing, but then when he started getting asked to speak about it, that was a whole nother thing. Yeah. And you can tell even, well, seriously, you know, you can write something on a piece of paper, but saying the words is like just even a while ago. It's very difficult.
Yeah.
Well, what was that? Well, do you remember that poll that was done of Americans like 20 years ago? Would you rather die or give a speech in public?
Well, we don't like public speaking either.
Yeah, more people would rather die than give up. So
right.
Yeah, so that is terrifying in many ways, and you're talking about something very intimate and important to you. So Rita, you deserve a lot of credit, and you also and Matthew, you know, you should be thanking Rita because, man, she is promoting and pushing the documentary so wonderfully. Matthew, would you mind if I played that 3-minute trailer from Manchu?
That's fine.
That's on your website.
Absolutely.
I think it would kind of bring it, you know, bring it to life for people. So what I'm going to do is, okay, share sound. And then I'm going to click this and click that. All right. So this is Manchu. It's about a little over 3 minutes. And here we go.
This was the first thing that scared me was the noise. Knowing we were getting helicopter.
One day we got in the Hardy OC, if you would, and that was really a terrible day for me and everybody else I know.
It was actually Thanksgiving Eve that it happened. We were on, they called it seek and destroy missions. The spotter planes would see fresh digging or enemy movement or something. They would mark it on a map. Then they would prep the area with artillery. And then we would fly in looking for body counts and weapons and food caches and stuff like that.
Hey,
Well, the day it happened, we were supposed to go to 5 different locations, and we'd made 2 of them. We had 10 choppers with 6 fighting men on each chopper. We'd made 2 locations with no trouble or anything, and it was like 11 o'clock, and Captain told us all, said, we're going to knock off for dinner. Somebody got in trouble and needed our choppers. And I was so hot, and now I didn't even eat my lunch. I took one bite of a pork patty and threw my lunch away. And then about 1 o'clock, he said, everybody saddle up. We're going to our next mission.
We flew in. I think there was 5 choppers went in first and then 5 more behind us. And I was in about, I think, the 2nd chopper. And it was a hot LZ, and I remember there was a gunship beside me just firing all he could fire. And it was just terrible. We just couldn't believe how much shooting was going on.
And we were going into a rubber plantation. And all hell broke loose.
Roger, we had visual on contact.
I jumped out of the helicopter about 20 foot off the ground. He was hollering, get out, get out. I never even knew when I hit the ground. I was so scared that I would forget to breathe. And I go, and oh, I gotta breathe, you know. And they was shooting down that elephant grass, it'd fall across my back, it'd feel like a telephone pole hit on there. There was estimated 2,000 in the wood line, and we flew into it with 60 people. 17 got killed going in.
Wow. Man.
Wow. That is quite a trailer. Matthew, extremely good work.
Yes.
Yes.
I want to invite people to ask questions, make comments before we move on. Mm-hmm. Matthew, I imagine they're still, you know, with finishing touches, there's still fundraising, I'm sure, that you're doing and to support the documentary. How can people support it if they want to, or how could they learn more?
Absolutely. So we do have a website up, and I unfortunately do not have that link to show here. But if you do type in, I'll let Mrs. Adams take over with that as well. She's been helping with getting that website instrumental, and I appreciate that very much. But, you know, a lot of it is not just monetary. It's also putting out word that we're making this documentary. I financed most of it. And it is, I am a school teacher outside of here. I just got out of the Army Reserve this past December. So I've had to do a few things in the time of it. But my point is, you know, letting people know that we are making a documentary that is uniquely different than most Vietnam documentaries. Something that actually tells a story of a soldier on the ground and actually lets them communicate their story. That's what we want to have put out there. So if we could spread that word, that would be excellent.
You're a teacher. What do you teach?
Social studies, civics. Right now I work with adult education as well, so I teach a little of everything. But yeah, I've been teaching since 2015.
Yeah. You're a man of many talents, because that film is that looks absolutely riveting. And the fact that you could handle teaching kids is that right? Not right, Scott Masters? It takes a special somebody to teach those young minds.
So,
well, I did put links to Mokay Namul City, Vietnam memoir by Stan, and to Lucky Snipe, the production company, and also to the Manchu movie. Mm-hmm. So if people want to support it or, you know, be in touch with you about it, they could just click that link.
That's wonderful. Thank you.
Hey, Matthew, and I would love to have you and as many Manchus as we could get back on, mm-hmm. screen the film, and then have a good conversation with you guys.
Sounds good.
Okay.
Look forward to it.
Let's talk about that. All right. Thank you, Rita. Thank you, Stan. Hey, yes. Sean, why don't you? Excuse me, I'm sorry.
I said thank you so much, Todd.
You bet. And is there anything, Rita, call to action for, do you have a call to action that you would encourage people to do to support the movie or support the Manchus?
Well, I think I couldn't find my flyer. Maybe you have the flyer, but on that flyer, it says, I think that the website is manchumovie.edutech.com. Can you check on that for me, Todd?
Okay.
You see, it says it's got the QR code on the flyer, and yes, then it's got the web address listed as well.
Yes. Let me
so
do
you can that. Go to that. You know, if you don't want to do the QR code, which a lot of our generation, we don't. So we wanted to go to the website. So that will take you to that website. And so it does have a link for like doing sponsorships. We're having the veterans register that are coming to the documentary red carpet and everything. And so I'll have name tags for them. Actually our daughter Kim's website, luckysnipe.com, that you can order online tickets through that.
Right. And that's what that is the link that I put in the chat.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
So people can go here.
So that, and then, but there is a just on the regular website, it does say like, how to become a sponsor or something. So I don't know whether you want to try to go that manchumovie.edutech.com. I think that's it.
Okay.
I was going to say, Matt made these wonderful posters as well. So that poster on that website with Lucky Snipe was Stan. There were several pictures of Stan on there. He's just done a phenomenal job on making the posters. And I have no idea how a person works two jobs, this full time. And, you know, Matt spent like $20,000 of his own money to get this done.
Yeah.
Okay. So that, there is become its sponsor. It's right there is where you would click.
Watch the trailer, which we just watched.
Right, yes. Right. Yeah, so you missed it. I don't know if you wanted to go back up to that, Todd, where it said right here on the right, become a sponsor.
Yeah, become a sponsor right here.
Yeah, so you could click on that, and then maybe if you wanted to. Anyway, then there's levels listed. And so with that, we're giving, as a thank you, small token appreciation, some tickets to the movie. And there'll be a loop around and showing the sponsor's name and their logo. I get those from them. And they'll be listed in the program and everything. So it's very much just to pay for the expenses of the documentary. And then also, if there's anything left over, we'd like to give it to Mr. Wilcox for him to continue his work. The documentary is only from like mid-68 to April of 70. So he really would like to tell the earlier stories of the guys that took the ship over starting in 66. Because, I mean, there was the ambush at Hockmon on March the 2nd of 68, where they lost 49 guys in just a few minutes. The Manchus lost 428 men during those 4 years and 7 months. They just really saw a lot of action. And they had three Medal of Honor recipients, too.
I hope everyone just heard this. This is Rita. Oh. This is not a member of the Manchus. This is somebody who educated herself and became an advocate. It's fascinating. Hey, Al Smith, how are you?
Good, good. I just want to kind of reinforce or second a couple of things that were said. One that to this day amazed me. My background, I was with the 1st Infantry Division. I was there the year before you had left. And I was up in a Michelin rubber plantation.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I think you were with Tropical Lightning, the 25th Infantry Division.
Yes.
We were all in what they call 3 Corps, all the way up to the Cambodian border.
Right.
But the two things that just struck me and it just reminded me, I was amazed at how little we were trained to what we encountered in Vietnam. And I mean, in the first month there, I had to learn so much. I was a second lieutenant. I was learning from privates and, you know, my sergeant and whatever, had to talk on the radio without ever talking by breaking squelch.
Yeah.
You had to call in rounds when you can't see where the round lands. You do it by sound. I mean, the things that we learned, OJT, and I just couldn't believe our government was going to send us into the jungle to fight a war. And we were totally unprepared how to fight the war. So literally, you had to rely on the guys who were there for a while to what happened.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing about the VA, I have a good friend, I may have mentioned this on one of these calls, who was in the Battle of the Idrang Valley. That was the first major battle in 1965. And there was a movie made of it and whatever. And they took terrible losses. And when he came home, he tried to commit suicide twice. Mm-hmm. And he was ready to get divorced, and his life was ready to go over the cliff. And he went to the VA, and that saved his life. Yeah. They literally, and today you wouldn't know he has PTSD, but what the VA did with him, if he didn't go to the VA, he would be dead today. I know that. So I just thought I'd add those things.
Well, that's a good point. Yes.
I see Jerry Augustine is with us. Jerry traveled with us to Vietnam last year in November and December. Jerry, you were with the 196th Light Infantry Brigade right in that same area, right? Tay Ninh?
We arrived there in August of 66, and we built the Tay Ninh base camp.
Wow.
Right at the base of Nui Ba Dan.
Yeah.
Yep.
We were in battles all around there, search and destroy missions, helicopter assaults. And, there was 4,000 of us. And we were new, and we were guinea pigs to the M16. We trained with the M14 for 10 months.
Right.
We were given the M16 when we got over there. And boy, I tell you, we had a lot of trouble with it.
Oh.
Until they gave us chrome bolts, and then we were guinea pigs.
Yeah. Oh, so you got the M16 at the very worst, at the very worst of it.
Yeah, yeah. We were on the whole
show. They got a lot of new equipment.
Yeah.
Right, yeah. But I think I was there the same day Al was, and we worked with the 1st Infantry Division.
Yeah, Big Red One, huh? Yeah.
Yes. Okay. We actually carried our 38 bodies in the Battle of Dao Tang.
Yeah.
Wow. The first week of November of 66.
Wow.
We were putting Big Red One guys in body bags.
Yeah.
Right off of the Ho Chi Minh Trail.
And Jerry, would you agree with Al and Stan that you weren't prepared the way you should have been for what you encountered?
We trained in the dead of winter with snow up to our chests up in Camp Drum, New York, and New England, right through. And then 4,000 of us were put on two ships and 33 days to get to Vietnam. And when we arrived, we built a Tay Ninh base camp. We really weren't that prepared. No jungle training whatsoever.
Yeah. I'd like to say one thing. Around Tay Ninh, they had two rubber plantations.
Yes.
They had the Michelin rubber plantation, and they had Philo. That was about the only place that our unit, you couldn't go into there, because somehow they had set up an agreement with the enemy or whatever that nobody would destroy the rubber trees. And that was anytime you were doing an operation, Renegade Woods or anything like that over there, you're going to get shot at. And that's where they were. They were inside of it, down into the plantations. And, some plantations are just acre after acre after acre. I don't know how big they are, but they were huge. So, yeah. Did you notice that? Or?
Yeah. When I got transferred in March of 67, into the 4th Infantry Division, we were based right inside the Michelin rubber plantation.
Wow. Yeah.
You can see right in my photos, the rubber, we're right among the rubber trees.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And if we destroyed a rubber tree, it was $1,000.
Right. You pay for it. Yeah.
To pay Michelin rubber. Yeah.
Yeah. We had that same thing. We had during the rainy season, you go out, we were in the rice paddies. You get off in the paddies. But they water buffalo out there, they're working. If they smelt you, man, they would charge you. And we had a machine gunner, a guy named Richens. I don't know how many of them he shot, but every time we got off the chopper, we were, they were running at you, and they're huge animals, So it was just something I'd never seen before. And when nobody trained you for that, that's for sure.
How do you fight a war when if you hit a tree, you're going to be fined $1,000? Oh my God. Yeah. Just amazing. Thank you so much, guys. Thank you, Stan and Rita. Yeah. Thank you, Matthew and Jerry and Al, for what you contributed to this conversation. I do hope you'll join us again, Matthew. I know you don't have much time, but we'd love to have you. Love to have you again. And Jim Roberts has another question that he asked to ask the group. He requested to ask the group, and I could. I'll ask the question. Do you want me to ask the question, Jim?
Go ahead.
Which did you prefer to veterans of a certain age, buttons or brass?
He's coming. Let me say before you get into that, this is a sad thing to go to after what we just talked about. I mean, this is really not where you want to go. Let me just say to the guys that were talking, I was around Nui Balra, which was in Three Corps east of you, and I was there in 71 after you guys had left. And I was working with the Rough Pups. Even the Arvin wasn't in there. We were the regional force and popular force. And we had mission plantations too. In fact, an ambush, it was set for us, but for some reason, our battery was dead. Regional vice president went through the ambush first and got blown away. And he turned out to be a relative of the Michelin family. It caused a major, major, major uproar. But operating in rubber, I had the same rules. I could give American gunships and American artillery permission to fire, but I couldn't give it to them in real rubber. It had to be old rubber. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you right now, we operated in rubber one time, and it's like operating in a house of mirrors with no mirrors. Left, right, diagonal, it all looks the same. And there's no light. This was old rubber that wasn't cleaned. It's right. In the tunnel. And if you lose track of the guy in front of you, you may never find him.
Yeah.
It is not a place you want to be. And we got the Vietnamese captain I was working with, he got us out of there as quick as he could because we did not want to be there. And, you know, it just really bad. So the only thing I want to say is thank you guys for doing what you did. Because you cleaned it up enough to where the locals could take care of it and provide some protection, which kept my butt out of the fire more than I'd like to think. So my hats are off to you for doing the work that you did.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
So back to Button to Breast. Todd, what do you think I'm asking about? You said you thought you knew.
I think I have an idea. I think it has to do here. Let me share my screen here. Hold on a second.
Yes. I don't know whether this was Fort Dix or Fort Polk. I was at Dix for basic and Polk for AIT. But at some point in there, soldiers started getting issued brass zipper for their flies. And they were really happy. Now, please correct me if you remember. My memory is we got five pair of fatigues when we checked in. We're supposed to have two in a locker, two in a wash, and one on. Which meant if you went out Monday and got filthy and put your second set of fatigues on Tuesday and got filthy, you were wearing filthy clothes for the next 5 days. So the guys that got zippers thought these were really great, but it's somewhere in the middle of training, they were coming back from the laundry with broken zippers.
Oh, gosh.
Now, those buttons never came off. But if they did, you could sew them back on. But when you've got five pair of fatigues and four pair of broken zippers and the other pair's in the laundry, you're going to be an interesting person when you turn out for formation. And so my question is, you know, does anyone have a feeling? What is the preference from those people who were in that time, whether they preferred buttons over brass? When I was in OCS, we had to buy fatigues because we broke starch twice a day. I always bought button fatigues and I wore button fatigues every place I went. And I was fortunate enough after I was commissioned, I never really had to wear my Class A uniform to work. I was always in a position, either training people or being trained, where we were turned out in fatigues every day. And so, the first time I put on a pair of pants that had a zipper on them was when I de-rosed ETS and my wife picked me up at the airport and she had a change of clothes for me.
And your wife might be interested to know that for your birthday, if she wanted to get you something really special, she could buy you actually these genuine Vietnam era fatigues for $75. And
they only have a... They're not. They don't have thigh pockets on them. I'm sorry. They're not. They may be army, but they're not jungle.
But they're not jungle fatigues, and they're out of stock anyhow. Okay. Well, scratch that idea.
I just wonder if anyone else has a thought about that.
We will put it out there. Buttons or brass? Any preference? Didn't the Navy have 13 buttons? I remember hearing our World War II vets talk about that. Chad Riddle? I'm going to ask you, right? The 13 colonies, something like that? 13 original states? Hey, okay, Bob Von Bargen is also nodding his head. All right.
Yes, they are. And boy, you better not have to go in a hurry.
That's a lot. It sounds like a lot of buttons. Yeah, yeah. And Al, you put a big X. On your screen.
Yeah, I was going to raise my hand. I don't know why I got an X. It's my low tech.
Okay.
Now, if I could just ask a question to the guys who are on the call, especially Jim, I'm very curious. He was there in 70. about the use of drugs and marijuana and whatever. When I was there, I never detected any of our guys, our troops, ever taking drugs, or maybe I was naive, but I never saw it. And God help the person who's taking drugs and go on an ambush patrol. But I understand later in the war, was it 69, 70, 71, where drugs became more prevalent? Is that true? Because I wasn't there. Jim is, yeah.
I was on a five-man team, and I was the only amateur. Everyone else was career. So the only problem we had was possibly alcohol. Our medic liked the heart. We had beer was a nickel a can, 10 cents for Budweiser. And we probably went through 70 cases of beer a month. But our medic liked hard stuff a little hard, but that was about the only problem. So I don't know. I mean, one of the beauties of my experience is, if you can believe it, I can say I had a good experience in Vietnam because I worked with the Vietnamese and we knew they were doing well. The only time I work with Americans is when we were calling in gunship support, medevacs, or artillery. And I never worked with Arvin. And so we were clear. We were clear. Maybe too much beer, but that was about it.
I in our unit, about all the way till June or July, very little drugs.
Which year?
1969. But when Nixon said he was bringing everybody home, the war changed. You know, there nobody wanted to go to the field anymore. It was just a different attitude of everything that was going on. And we had guys killed after that, which I, you know, could have been drugs. I don't know, but I never really was around it. So.
And yeah, I heard that it's, oh, Michael, maybe you'll be able to shed light on this. How are you, Michael? Haven't seen you in a while.
Haven't had much to say in a while. I went over in 71. And the first talk I got by my senior commander was that heroin was the big problem. He showed me the little capsules of heroin that were available. The Vietnamese brought them into the base camp, and people typically dipped the cigarettes in them and used that. Mm-hmm. That place that I was stationed was a rear area. And it hadn't seen any combat in the previous 2 years, and some people there regarded it as a vacation spot, mm-hmm. but there was drug use, mm-hmm. and it was serious. That's all. And
I've even heard Rick Weber, who has joined us. He was a company commander with the 101st Airborne Division. He was there in 1971. And he said it was better to be in the field than to be in the rear, because the rear was really so chaotic and so dysfunctional. And there was a lot of dangerous drug use and other violence and conflict. And boy, he just made it sound terrible. Let's see, Carl. Carl Zipperer, going to ask him to unmute. Just added something in the chat here. You should have told the truth. No. Carl, I'm asking you, Carl Zippert, on unmute if you'd like. You put a comment here in the chat. If you wanted to say your comment, you could do that. Bob Miswa, you were there that era. You were there in 70, 71, 72, even?
Yeah, I came in country to October 1970, took over as the support platoon leader for our armor battalion. Worst job I ever had in the Army. I had the Delta Dogs in an armor battalion unit, Alpha Bravo and Charlie Company. Well, they formed a D company for the Delta Dogs, the druggies, the drunks. And I'm going to tell you what, it was an unbelievable job. I mean, especially the drug users. I remember walking in on one kid. You know, he's got the damn rubber tube around. He's got the needle in his arm.
Oh, my God.
Higher than a kite. I'm going to be okay, LT. I'm going to be okay. I got Sergeant, get the MP in here. Get his ass out of here. And, I mean, the guys in our morning, for my first morning formation, I could not believe the guys that showed up just in the fatigue pants and a T-shirt. other guys disheveled because, you know, they were either drunk or high. Wow. I can only depend on one third of my guys. Mm. You know, what they did, anybody that washed out in Alpha Bravo and Charlie, they wound up in Delta. And then we had a real serious incident where our S1 got killed. He was a West Pointer. Him and the S2 were walking through the barracks just checking, and they came in on a bunch of, they were black soldiers who were into the black power thing. And they had told him, hey, how about keeping the music down? Well, the one guy just, he was all smoked up, pulled out a pistol and killed him. Mm. You know, and it was tough in the rear. It was tough in the rear. I was so happy to get my tank platoon out in the field because the guys were fantastic. That's all I can say. That's the best job I ever had was being a first lieutenant leading a tank platoon in Northern I Corps. The guys were unbelievably great. You know, wow. But that Delta company, holy crap. And then I remember all the black guys that were in that barracks where they shot the S1. They all got sent all over the country. And the guy that shot and killed the S1, he was sent to Leavenworth, 25 years hard labor. You know, it was crazy because, you know, a lot of guys, they didn't want to go out in the field because the war was winding down. You know, they were talking about it. And everybody, you know, had that attitude. Boy, I don't want to be the last one getting killed in Vietnam.
Yeah.
You know, that was very pervasive. You know, right. It was a crazy time.
And big morale problem.
Yeah. You take the marijuana cigarettes, the Mamasans laced them with heroin. So as soon as someone started smoking marijuana, they got hooked on heroin. And a $5 a day habit over there turned into a $50 a day habit over here. Mm. So that just shows you the deleterious effects of that.
Carl Zipperer, what's your memory of that time?
I tell you, I was really surprised at some of the people who were smoking pot because they were some of the top performing people in the unit. Not during combat, but at night. It seemed it was you had the NCOs slept in one hooch, and a lot of the people who, you know, were, yeah, the NCOs, and they threw liquor bottles at the potheads in the pothead hooch, and the potheads threw stuff over there, and the ones that were doing heroin threw caps over there at their hooch. I remember a guy dying underneath the hooch from a heroin overdose. Apparently he was trying to retrieve a needle that had fallen through the cracks. And I really hate to say it, but it was rampant where I was. I was stationed at Chulai, and I was in an aviation unit. And it was rampant amongst some of the enlisted men. It was really bad. In the field, there were guys smoking pot in the field. There were guys smoking pot on our helicopters as we were putting them in for a combat assault, which I thought was actually crazy, but I could smell it, you know. I was a pilot. Pot use was so prevalent. No, I don't remember anybody ever getting busted for it. Heroin was a different story. How about that?
That's
the way it was.
Yeah.
And it really did. It didn't start until after they declared Vietnamization and people started coming back. And the gentleman who was speaking just before me, he told it exactly like it was. Nobody wanted to be the last guy. But there were people trying their best to do their jobs. It wasn't that there weren't, you know what I'm saying? And I mean, that's just the way it was.
Carl, that's a devastating, that helps me to understand a certain class of our veterans, you know, especially Army veterans who served in Vietnam between, say, 70 and 1973. And several of them have said, like, they really came home and wanted to forget the whole, wouldn't have anything to do with Army reunions or anything like that.
Right.
But it's only been recently that they've started to kind of reclaim their service experience.
Yeah. you're dead on with that. And there's a lot of people reclaiming it. I just happened to have a lot of contact with people probably in the late 90s on. I had a lot of contact with a lot of veterans, and I couldn't tell you how many people over the last 25, 26 years said, you know, they've never talked about it, never said a word. I met a friend of mine that I was in basic training with back in, even in 1983 or 84, sat at a table with his family and ate with him. And we started talking about basic training, and I asked him about Vietnam, and his kid's mouth just popped open. They'd never heard him say a word about it.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Boy, is this an interesting conversation. Renee Johnson, you were in Vietnam in 1970, and I think you said you saw a tipping point with drug use there.
I did. I was there my first year, 69 to 70, April, and came back to the States. And when I left from 25th Infantry Division, and we were seeing part of the 9th because two brigades had already gone home. When I went back over in September with another organization, I went to Bearcat, and same basic AO area of operation. And some of those same guys from the 9th that I'd seen, you know, before were then by that time stationed at Bearcat. They were guys that had been MRFA, Riverine Forces before. And my second day at Bearcat, one of them came up to me and said, "Weren't you here before, you know, with Red Cross?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Oh, you will not believe the changes." And he started telling me about the difference in drug usage. Through that next 10 months that I was there, I saw the increase just skyrocket from going to what I had seen in early 70 from occasional people using grass to heroin. And exactly like Michael said, the little vials of heroin. When I left out of Fuloy, we had a company, our base commander, that was so concerned. He had a plexiglass box, 3x3x3 built with a small hole in the top. His goal was to fill that box with confiscated heroin before he left a year later. Within 3 months, the box was full.
Oh, my.
It was unbelievable. And if anybody ever has the time or inclination to read The Politics of Heroin in Southeast Asia by Alfred B. McCoy, it talks about that and how they were really pushing on the reduced morale by bringing in drugs. We had the Thai Sikhs at Bearcat because the Thai soldiers, the Thai Black Panther Division was stationed there, and they were bringing it over and selling it. It's hard for me to describe all of it, but I ended up leaving because I found out one of the sources from Bearcat to Fuloy, and my life was threatened if I said anything. I'm not saying that to sound, it was a very scary situation by that time. It's the communists were really pushing the heroin onto the American soldiers because it helped suppress their desire to fight or anything else. But interestingly enough, I learned just recently from the VA that although these guys were coming back with heroin addictions and some of the stories about them being locked on islands and everything coming back, they didn't stay hooked on it as long as drug users here in the States do. And I don't know why, but there seemed to be some disconnect there between what they were seeing. But I heard about it from True Life and people I'd known before when I was there my first year, from some of the pilots with Blue Ghost specifically, Carl. And if I had to do it all over again, I wouldn't have gone back because it was a completely different situation. It was like there was this war and then there was this war, and it was, you know, people say, well, I was there in 67, 68, I never saw it. No, you didn't see it. It wasn't like that.
Right.
It really increased. It was very scary.
Very scary, to the point where one of your own Donut Dollies, Ginny Kirsch, pictured here, was murdered by an American GI who had a bad drug problem, also very bad mental illness, of course.
Well, the mental illness, I think, was the prevailing issue in that particular situation. But that was a horrible thing because she actually was killed in the same room I had lived in for 6 months.
Oh, my.
So that really bothered me a lot.
And one of our veterans here who comes to our events had dinner with Ginny before she was killed and really has a hard time talking about that one. But just
I can imagine
to him, he just did say her murder was exemplified the chaos and insanity that it just was disintegrating. It seemed like the American war effort and life on these bases was really disintegrating. I'm a little puzzled, and Renee, I'm sure you explained it a little bit. David McComb might be able to explain it too. How did so much drugs get to GIs? I mean, were they going into villages and buying it? Who are they buying it from? Dave, do you remember this time?
Well, I was on an ammo ship and working on a chopper doing some medevacs and doing transfer of ammo to ships coming off the gun line when we were there. But we discovered it, the mailman, every time he flew in for mail, he was bringing it and selling it to people on the ship. And it took us a long time to track that down, but that's how most of it got on. And then when we got back, say like to the Philippines, and we were restocking the ship, people went ashore and, you know, the hookers were selling it to them and everybody. So they would, it just kept worse and worse. And I remember Thanksgiving one of the years I was there, we got called into the mess decks, and there was a table piled high with drugs and pot sitting there, and there was a big sign in it said, "Happy Thanksgiving. Be thankful we caught it and not the customs," because we were heading back. And wow. So they put it on the flight deck on the back of the ship, set it all on fire, and we headed into the wind. So the wind was blowing away from the ship. Because everybody's out there trying to suck air, you know, to get.
Oh my God.
It was pretty crazy. Yeah, it was coming in from different things. It was, and we didn't know about some of it until they brought the dogs on. And they brought the dogs on in one of the ports we were at. And it was at night. And the next morning is when they had the mess decks filled with it, but people were hiding kilos in the wiring of the ship. And the CO was going down one of the hallways and he looked up and he wondered what the heck's that up in the wire. And he pulled down a kilo. And so they did a mass search of the ship. We got stuck in port till they cleared it all off. It was pretty crazy. We'd never get home. I thought we were going to get stuck in Hawaii on the way home too. They did a thorough search of the ship before we could come back in.
Boy, this is fascinating. Michael, you had something to say?
On Hantre Island, well, we had an isolated signal outpost, but we had also civilian workers come in on a daily basis, and the civilian workers brought the stuff with them and sold them directly to the troops. We had our commanding officer at one point decided he wanted to stop it, so he brought in a Vietnamese MPs to do this. The trouble was everybody came over to the island on an LST-type ship. So when the ship came over with the civilian workers and there was these Vietnamese officials, military officers who were recognized as police officers, people were throwing the stuff over the edge so that they wouldn't get caught with it.
Yeah.
I mean, the commanding officer said, "Okay, we goofed that one. Next time we'll have to bring the cops in by helicopter." And that was nominal.
We went into Grande Island in the Philippines, and it was like an R&R place. We could get away. And then somebody was out on the island hiking and guess found pot growing on the island. They were harvesting it and bringing it back to the ship. It was crazy. And it was like some of the people, like someone said, would surprise you. There was parties going on in the boatswain's forward locker, and they busted it and found like some of the officers there, which surprised me. Some of the commanding people, and it was like, who's running this ship? It was kind of scary, you know. We didn't know what was going on.
So I've heard from so far that the people who brought the drugs in were, or the people who supplied the drugs to service members were Vietnamese civilians. The Thai military, you're saying, Renee?
Yes.
U.S. service members getting it somewhere and you know, and selling it. And then also this was a tactic, you say, Renee, by the enemy to demoralize.
According to Alfred McCoy's book, it was.
And that would make sense that it would be.
Yeah.
Bill Boswell. This is an eye-opening conversation and a dispiriting one. And I think it helps to explain the special trauma of the Vietnam War. Let's have Bill Boswell and then Bob Mizwa. Bill?
Yes, Todd. Moving around the world, when I was stationed in Germany in the 70s, it almost destroyed the military because the drugs available there were very strong. And the information we were getting from the OSI, the Air Force's version of the FBI, was that most of them were coming in from the Chinese to destabilize NATO. So that was a tactic.
It was. And you mentioned in the chat here, you said drugs almost destroyed the military in the 70s, especially in Europe. Operation Golden Flow saved us. What's Operation Golden Flow?
Pee in the bottle. Unannounced drug testing.
Is that a joke or is it really called?
No, that's what it was called. Honest to God. And my favorite experience is it could happen to anyone at any time. I was a prosecutor in a trial in a court martial, and my name came up for an unannounced drug test. So the judge had to recess the trial while I peed in the bottle. And as soon as I finished, I came back and we started up again. The other thing that I found entertaining is when you did have a trial, you had to bring the evidence in. So when we brought in large numbers of bags of marijuana, we had a lot of the local druggies come in to view the trial because they'd sit in the back of the courtroom and sniff heavily. So eventually we had to cut back on the amount of evidence we brought into the court martial.
Oh my gosh. My oh my. Bob Mizwa.
Renee, I was told those little plastic, I remember seeing them when we confiscated them, was pure white. And the potency was 99% pure heroin.
And that's I remember
one of the NCOs I had in my Delta company in my platoon. He was always walking around with one of those little Vicks inhalers, complaining he needed it. Here he was putting the heroin in a Vicks inhaler and just inhaling it and walking around staying high all day long. So, you know, and like they said, you get back in the United States, the heroin they bought on the street was not 99% pure. It was cut. So it took a lot more of that stuff if you got really hooked on it when you come back to the U.S., you know.
But for some reason, like I said, counselors with the VA and some workshops that I was in said that people didn't stay addicted to it like they do when they get hooked on it here in the States. I don't understand that. Well, but thank goodness.
You know what I think is once they got back to the States, the pressure was off.
Mm-hmm. Could so be.
It, to me, it would be easier to recover because, you know, everybody was looking for some way to cope with what they had to deal with over there. It's like, I might be dead tomorrow. I might get my legs blown off. I might go home, you know, quadriplegic, you know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden you come back to the United States. So I don't need this crap anymore. You know, I think that's a major factor.
Ben Wright.
Yeah. To echo what Bill Boswell was talking about, the no notice urinalysis was very effective in the Air Force. And I got called to do that too. And you had to have a witness that in fact was your urine going in the bottle. And, but the Air Force, you know, one use, you know, one positive and, the discharge, happened fairly quickly and the problem went away fairly quickly with them. You know, and some of the, they were general discharges at the best. and some of them were general with under other than honorable conditions, and they were just shown the door. And as an air crew member, you really got irritated with it in Southeast Asia, because even air crews, every time you went anywhere, they went through your bag and every sock, you know, looking for stuff. You got tired of all this drug inspection stuff. It was just such a terrible inconvenience, and they didn't seem to be catching anybody. And then they finally caught a guy, a life support guy, that he had put it in a sealed LPU, those are underarm life preserver bags, on the aircraft. And they caught him. And so they put him in handcuffs, and we took him back to the Philippines for whatever judicial proceedings. And somewhere between an aircraft and a security police station, the bag disappeared, and they had to drop the charges. And we were just irritated because we get so tired of this stuff, you know, and all the inconvenience and the problems. But at least the Air Force dealt with it, and people who were caught with it, they were gone.
But Ben, you're flying these C-130s that require a lot of maintenance, a lot of mechanics, you know, aviation experts. Were you ever concerned? I mean, that, you know, some of these guys may have been whacked out and not being able to do their jobs.
Well, we just didn't tolerate drug use. And in fact, we would have people, they would show up obviously under the influence of alcohol, and things didn't go well for them.
Yeah.
You know, we just didn't tolerate that stuff, because it's, you kill people that way.
Yeah.
And the Air Force took it very serious. But of course, in Southeast Asia, you know, the it got congressional interest. And so a lot of these measures came into being because Congress was getting, you know, very concerned about what was going on in the military with illicit drug use.
Boy, is this interesting. Don Nemchek, how are you, Don?
I'm doing well. Todd, if my voice is a little bit bad, I had some dental work this morning, so I'm a little bit fuzzy and under the influence of
speaking
drugs.
Of drugs, yeah.
Speaking of drugs, yeah. Well, you have to remember, in 1969, after Woodstock, the nation became very persuaded that drug use was starting to be tolerated. Marijuana was feel good, do it, it's harmless, it's Mother Nature. And that carried over to the draftees, of course, in most cases, when they went over into Vietnam 71. My experience, May of 71, I got deployed to Naval Communications Station Guam. And we were all getting our top secret special category clearances because we were working on some very highly classified material. We had a bevy of radio men and a big contingent of communication technicians, CTs, called spooks. And they, again, we had to go through the golden flow as well. But a lot of guys took advantage of Nixon's drug amnesty program, because what would happen is, see, I got tired, fellows would say, I got tired of the Navy, this isn't for me, I'm out of here. All they had to do was sign a paper that they were they had taken drugs and they wanted to go into Nixon's amnesty program. So all that expensive training that we received for a year or so in order to prepare for going into communications in a very classified environment was all for naught, because all these guys had to do was take the easy way out, raise their hand, and they had a whole division of them on Guam. And in order for them to be processed, there was a waiting period for them. And they were separated from us for obvious reasons, but they were free to go about their business during the day, and they faced no repercussions. And I think what my point being is, there was no repercussions. They got a general discharge. They didn't get a dishonorable discharge. They got a general discharge in 1971 because they wanted to take the easy way out. Seeing many of those guys, if they had a problem and they needed help, that's not my point. These guys claim they smoked the joint and they're going to take the easy way out and go home and live free again. And that means someone else had to take your duty too. But yeah. My point being, all that expensive training, all the duty that you sworn to do, you just took the easy way out. And that was because, again, Nixon did an amnesty program. The country was very persuasive. Look where we are now with fentanyl. Look where we are with a lot of weeds going to be legalized in Pennsylvania, probably, which is ill-advised. I don't care about the revenue stream. But these are the type of things that happen. And the fellows that are discussing their experiences in country, many guys that I knew come back home And that's exactly where they went. They said, oh, man, you don't believe the stuff that we had over there. Let's go down the street and get some over here. And the beginning of the society that we are almost in today.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Don. Yeah, the opioid crisis, the recruiting crisis in the military. It's a tad comforting to know that we faced crisis before. Before we go to Bob Flage, I do want to go back to Bill Boswell. Bill?
Yes, the military had learned a few lessons from amnesty. By the mid-70s, there was no amnesty, at least in the Air Force. There were two ways you could do it. If you turned yourself in, we gave you an administrative discharge. It might be under other than honorable conditions. If you did not turn yourself in, we would court-martial you and give you a BCD, bad conduct discharge. And at that point, the drug usage dropped dramatically. I would even say it tanked. But to Ben's point, since we were both stationed at Bitburg, not at the same time, if you did the drug test, someone had to observe you doing it. And eventually it got to the point, because some people were clever with tubes and someone else's urine and so forth, you had to really observe what was going on, which was uncomfortable for the person doing the observing. But it worked. I would say within 6 months, things changed dramatically. So amnesty does not work. Having a choice of column A or column B does work.
Does work. How interesting. Thank you, Bill. Bob Flage, you saw a little bit of both. You were in Vietnam before the drug problem took off, but then you remained in the military after the war, your career. And so you must have seen it back home, right?
Yes. Well, first of all, with the MRF, the Army that I was in, units, obviously there was no use there. When our battalions were on the boats, there was no place anybody could go smoke and not be seen or smelled. Now, when I came back, I had still had 10 months left in my enlistment, and I was at Fort Hood. And later, towards the end of that period, you could tell some of these guys were coming back and, you know, still looking for drugs. We had an orientation one time, and they passed out joints. I don't know why they had a show, you know, show and tell thing, but when they called for them back, they passed out 8, and 10 of them came back. So, you know, drug use was still rampant at back home at that point at Hood when I was there.
Boy, oh boy. And Bob, you sent me some wonderful pictures I'm going to show in a second. Okay. Jim Roberts, if you could unmute.
Yeah, you talk about the drug test. I left Vietnam in December 71, and I went out through MACV since I was an advisor, and part of getting out of there was the drug test. And talking about uncomfortable observing, we had to use the golden flow test. They lined us up 5 in a row, and we dropped our drawers, they handed us a cup, and we stood there naked from the waist down with the medics watching us while we filled the cups. That was because of
two. Sorry to laugh, but yeah,
things like that, and that was the way it was. And if you'd been to the bar and had drunk too much beer, the specific gravity of the urine wasn't good enough for them to run the test. You had to come back.
Wow.
And so I mean, again, this was MACV and advisors getting out, which were mostly senior enlisted and officers. But we had to pass the test, or we weren't coming home.
You know, I was looking at Ed Cottrell, who's here with us, 102-year-old World War II fighter pilot, Julia Parsons, World War II, 103-year-old Navy wave. You know, they must be thinking like, wow, I can't imagine fighting a war under those conditions, fighting a war when you, Ed?
Yes.
I mean, I was looking at you thinking, what a difference between your experience. I mean, I know there had to be a lot of drinking in Europe and elsewhere, but what's your reaction to what you've been hearing about this Vietnam?
I'm appalled that
what happened from the beginning of the Vietnam War to the end of how drugs took over. During my service in the military, drugs was never even considered. I mean, nobody ever talked about drugs. Alcohol was a problem.
Yeah.
If you drank too much beer, you couldn't fly. And they policed the bars that were on the our officers' clubs that were on the bases. They monitored them very carefully. But I sit here and listen to these people, and they really had a problem for themselves if they were trying to control the situation.
And how long were you in the Air Force, Ed?
I was in the Air Force from 42 to 45 on active duty.
Okay. Yeah, so you didn't come close to seeing all this stuff.
No, nothing at all like this.
Man, I just don't know how you fight a war, hold a military together. Bob Flage, you sent me some wonderful photos, and I want to move on. This is one of them. I did a double take at this photo because it just looked like I thought, is he sitting next to statues? I mean, this is a wonderful photograph. This is you sitting on this ancient wheelbarrow?
Correct, yes. I was a squad leader at that time in the 2nd Platoon, and the fellow in the rear, he was the 3rd Platoon platoon sergeant, and the guy to the left was the 1st Platoon sergeant. And this is a break right after Tet, early February, when we were out still looking for a battalion of Charlie's out in the woods around Canto area.
And that's in the Delta, in the Mekong Delta.
Yes, yes.
In what year?
This is 60, well, this will be February 68.
February 68, you said that. Okay, so during Tet. And this looks like the first wheelbarrow ever built.
It probably was, but it was sturdy. It held me up.
Yeah, it held you up. Man, platoon leader. Oh, I can't imagine the difficulty of that job. You mentioned an email to me about him.
This is the same location, same date. This is Bob Jenks. He was going to be a squad leader. He was picked to be a squad leader. And unfortunately, this is, like I said, early February. March 1st, we were on an operation. He came to me and said, "Let me lead the parade tonight." And he said, "You're going home eventually, and I'm going to be taking over. Let me take over." And I didn't think of it long enough or hard enough, I guess, but I did. We made contact, and somebody called in air support. They fired two rockets at us. He was in front of me. We were in a banana grove, and he was two rows over in front of me, and they missed us with the rockets. I'm deaf in my right ear. I could see where the first one impacted just to my right, but they came back with another gun run, and he got hit with the minigun and killed him.
I'm looking at this photo. So he
this one ever since. I swear every night I think of him. He was from Concord, Michigan.
And that was on March 1st he was hit, and then March 2nd he died.
Yes, yes.
And I'm looking at this photo, and I just noticed two things right away. Number one, this is an AK-47, it looks like, right?
Yes, that's my AK-47.
That's yours.
It's interesting, yes, because... this is March 1st. February 26, 27, we got overrun. Bravo Company went into a hot LZ. They got chopped up. The choppers wouldn't take us in, so we had to walk our way in. We took over. We took one side of the LZ it was a base camp, a VC base camp with bunkers all around the rice paddy. my platoon had to go secure the other side. And when we got to the other side, I had tossed some grenades in a bunker that there were three of them in there. And this gun was in there. So I purloined it. And he just asked to hold it so he could have a picture. We got back. When we got back, I can't remember exactly when I had it in my hooch. Company commander came and said, when we got overrun, choppers came in and they shot up the whole area. And, if it wasn't for them, we wouldn't have gotten, none of us would have gotten out. But the company commander said, the lead pilot asked for an AK-47. Can I give him yours? And I gave it to him.
Oh. I love looking at pictures like this. And another thing that draws my attention is he was clearly in water, right?
Oh, yeah. Yep. Yep.
Oh, and I just think of leeches and having wet feet and the rainy season. He's got the towel around his neck that I think Jim Roberts told me about.
Yep. The do-rag. The do-rag.
The do-rag. He has the things in his helmet band here.
Yep. First aid pack matches.
Boy, oh boy. And here's a wonderful picture of him.
Yes. That's just after he got out of basic.
Dead 51 years. I'm sorry, 56 years.
Yeah.
Boy, oh boy.
Yeah, I talked to his uncle. The thing that upsets me about it, you look at his record, you can look him up and see, information about MOS unit, et cetera. They got him listed as killed in friendly fire, body recovered. And that's bothered me ever since. I was in touch with his uncle, who was, his nephew, who was named after him. And Bob's older brother was in Vietnam. He made it back, but he wouldn't discuss anything with me. I wrote a letter to the nephew and told him exactly what happened.
Boy, oh boy.
And at the last meeting we had, I told you that my platoon called me and Tom Hainer, the guy to my right. They called us the twins. We both came in we were replacements, and we came in and, we thought alike. We were the oldest two. Yeah, we were both 22 years old and both at college. We were both offered desk jobs at the 9th Division base camp. And we said, no, we want to go to the field. And so, okay, well, you can do that, stupid. And then they put us in the 3rd of the 60th Battalion headquarters. And they said, oh, we're going to make you two guys radio operators. And we pitched a fit for about 2 days. And they finally said, okay. I showed up in Echo Company, which Tom was at also. I showed up in Echo Company. The first sergeant's from Jacksonville. And he says, fly, get your bags and get over in the headquarters tent. You're the old man's driver. And I said, I want to go to the field. He says, get over there. And the old man couldn't find his Jeep for a couple of meetings he had to go to. And as I was out having driving around. And the first sergeant came back and says, get your bags and get over into recon. we were in a combat support company. And I had a recon platoon, a four-deuce platoon, 106 Jeep-mounted platoon.
And you didn't have drugs, but you did have these beers.
Yes, these beers are on the pontoon tied up next to the USS Benoit, which was the command ship. Fortunately, the 3rd of the 60th always got to get on the Benoit, which was, like I said, the command LST of the two. The other was just a floating barracks, didn't even have motors on it. It was pulled around by a tug. Right. But we got some beer delivered to us previously. And the Navy says you can't drink on the beach, on the boat. So they put everybody on the beach or along the Mekong. And, there were a couple guys with 16s out there supposedly guarding us. And we're all standing around there drinking. All of a sudden, the wood line opened up. We jump in the canal in the Mekong, and we're up to our neck hiding behind the bank. And here's this pad of beer just getting shot all up. I mean, it's hot, so it's buzzing and just cans are going everywhere. So the next time we got beer, the judge, they said, because we only got two, they said, okay, you guys, you better stay on the pontoon. You can drink on the pontoon.
Oh, my. And that happened right after this picture. Shooting it up. That happened, what you're talking about happened after this picture was taken.
No. We're on the pont. This is the second.
Oh, this is the second time. Okay, on the pontoon.
Second round of beer. The first round got shot up.
Got it.
We were sitting on the pontoon, so we wouldn't get shot at.
Got it. And this is the French fort in the Maine. Yes,
this is not a part of the Tisagni line that ran from, I don't know, from Hanoi to Gulf of Tonkin. This was on the on the Mekong River, and it was huge. I couldn't believe they made something this big. When we go out in the field for a period of time, a week or more, with the mobile riverine force to get out of the water, we'd go back to the boats. But if we were out longer, this is what we called our in-country R&R. We would go and support the 106 and 105s that were on shore. And this fort was one place where they always set up at. And it's interesting because all those boxes that looks like around the wall, those are water containers. That's how they, you know, they stored all their water there. And inside, and if you went down the stairs, that first building there is either bakery or the kitchen. But this was, I found French piastres laying on the ground around there. And over in the back picture, there's looks like there's a dome over there. That had some really heavy artillery pieces. The guns were gone, but there was a railroad system in the basement and a conveyor that brought it up, the shells up to the gun. So you know it had to be something like the guns in Navarone that these guys had. But, the cement that they used was just totally unbelievable.
Just an ancient French fort.
Okay, there out in the field, you can see just to the right, there's one of the guns out there. But this is facing inland, and there were two of these 105s, 106s sitting in a turret emplacement on top of the fort. And it's interesting because, like, on the end of the barrel, you had to walk around and duck your head out over the wall to look down the barrel. And I did that, and here's a baby cobra just sitting in there, standing up, hissing at me. So we left as friends there. Yeah. But the breach is gone, but there was another one of these weapons on the other end of the fort. So they faced inland. And there's more water bunkers out further on the field there. But we thought we were going to go, looking around the fort and to crawl down the stairs under the big ones. All of a sudden we hear splashes and went back, got a flashlight, and that basement was full of snakes. I mean, I thought it was that movie that, I don't know, what's his name, Harrison Ford played in. Yeah, but, that's what that reminds me of. But anyway, that was interesting, very interesting. We were there twice to pull security. The first time we thought there was splashing around in the rice paddy out in front of us. And we told the Army guys that, we don't think there's anybody out there, but we're just going to do some recon by fire. And we did, and we heard this splashing around, went out the next morning, there was nothing there. We came back a week later, one of my men, Mike Romeo from California, was out walking on the dike out in the rice paddy. All of a sudden, he comes running back screaming, he grabs his 16, runs back out there, and unloads a clip. And then he comes dragging back about a 12 to 14 foot cobra. Oh, that was gosh. Apparently, we figured we hit them when we were doing that night recon firing, because on about 3 feet from the end of his tail, it was a fester about the size of a baseball that this wound was, you could tell it was old. And that's all we can think of that made that splashing around. But we made the Arty guys real happy because we wrapped it. Wrapped the snake around the guy wires under the canopy where the one of the 155s had a canopy coming off with guy wires. Well, we wrapped that snake around the bottom of it. And the first guy that came out of there tripped over it. And all of a sudden, we just heard this guy. I mean, I've never heard anybody die, you know, with that kind of voice. Anyway, the RTD artillery commander asked our company commander not to let us pull security for him anymore. Just keep us away from him.
Oh my gosh. What a story, Bob. And Bob, you sent other pictures too, and I thought we'd share them at another time.
Okay.
Boy, I've really missed this open conversation. I'm looking at the clock. I see we're 7 minutes over time. This was really a wonderful experience. Awesome. And an educational one and inspirational. I would like to follow up on some of the stuff that we've been talking about. I know that you took a poll also, and maybe there's some suggestions in the poll for future topics to discuss open conversation. Our next one is going to be May 8th, open conversation. You'll be getting emails about that. But I hope you join us on Thursday night for our Greatest Generation Live, Masters of the Air, about American POWs in Germany. And then I hope to see some of you also at some of our upcoming events. Thank you all for participating tonight, and take care. Stay well. I'll see you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Okay, good night.
Night.
Thank you for watching this episode of The Scuttlebutt. I'd like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Tobacco Free Adagio Health. Tobacco Free Adagio Health has been supporting the podcast for quite some time now. We've been so pleased to be supported by them. They are dedicated to reducing and preventing tobacco use and getting the word out about the hazards of smoking and secondhand smoke. They're all about health, so they want people to quit. They have classes, nicotine replacement therapy, and a popular quit line, 1-800-QUIT-NOW. They also educate people, children especially, about tobacco use from cigarettes, cigars, pipes, chew, snuff, and other nicotine products like vaping. And finally, Tobacco Free Adagio Health advocates for public and private policies that ensure healthy places to live, work, and play. You can learn all about what Tobacco Free Adagio Health offers at tobaccofree.adagiohealth.org, or you can check out the two Scuttlebutt episodes that featured Tobacco Free Adagio Health. We had a wonderful representative come on to the podcast, talk to us about all the classes and therapies that they offer. It was two wonderful conversations, so I definitely direct you to both of those if you want more information, or just call their free quit line, 1-800-QUIT-NOW. Thank you again, Tobacco Free Adagio Health, for your support. We're grateful for the support of UPMC for Life, a UPMC healthcare Medicare program. At UPMC Health Plan, their goal is to improve the health of their members. They can also help you make sense of Medicare, get the answers and information you need, such as how to choose the Medicare Advantage plan that's right for you. UPMC for Life offers a wide range of affordable Medicare Advantage plans, and you military veterans can save money and get more benefits with your Medicare plans. UPMC for Life has plans designed for veterans by veterans. The type of coverage you have from your service may help you decide which plan will be a good fit. If you have TRICARE for Life, UPMC for Life PPO Salute may be a good fit for you. You can view plan options, including their prescription drug coverage, compare costs, and learn about all the benefits you get when you choose UPMC for Life by going to upmchealthplan.com/Medicare. Thank you so much, UPMC for Life, for sponsoring the Scuttlebutt.